It's Thursday, March 7th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Headline out of San Francisco: San Francisco is no longer a progressive city. And the evidence for that is that two citywide proposals, one that funded the police, one that required drug testing before benefits were given, those both passed. So this means San Francisco is no longer progressive. Good luck bringing that up in a San Francisco meeting that doesn't start with a land acknowledgement. And while that headline was derided, there was, I think, perhaps a little too much overinterpretation of the San Francisco result. Politico had a headline: saving the Democratic Party from itself, blue cities get tough on crime. To which Taniel, who is an online, I guess he's also an offline analyst of election results. He's a guy named Daniel Nikanian, and he's the editor-in-chief of Bolts Magazine. I've been following him for years when he was still a graduate student. He was coming out with excellent election analysis, and he's very much progressive, and he's very for progressive prosecutors, and he sometimes does put his thumb on the scale, but he raises a good point. If you're saying blue cities get tough on crime, he asks, how do you publish this 36 hours after Super Tuesday and not even mention Austin and Houston's election results? Counties combined population, 6 million people. He's right. I guess the more progressive prosecutor won, but I guess in both cases, the less tough on crime or more progressive prosecutor won. And I wondered why. In the case of Houston, murder was just out of control there, as it was in much of America, but it hit Harris County hard. The murder stats before the pandemic: 491 homicides, according to the Medical Examiner Service. In 2020, year of the pandemic, 662. In 2021, 720. That has begun to come down a little bit, but not enough, plus other missteps to allow Kim Ogg to keep her job. Not rhyming. That's her name. And that's the expression for not getting voted out of office. And she did lose the Democratic primary. It seems logical to me. Whereas in Austin, Travis County, though crime did spike from the 30s to the 60s in terms of homicide, it has gone down. The prosecutor was much more entrenched. And I looked at all the crime statistics for the county recently, and they all pretty uniformly are going down. Property theft is down. Murder is down. Fondlings are down. This is an official category of crime. I shouldn't laugh. It's not right to be fondled. It's just funny that there's someone who has to keep the fondling statistics. So it does sort of make sense in every election, overinterpreting national trends, especially on things like crime, which is very particular to different places. It's almost always a mistake. So it was a mistake for Politico to say big cities, big blue cities are getting tough on crime. And it was also a mistake for San Francisco to say we are no longer a very, very progressive city. Proof of that is if you assert it in public, you'll get a lot of people snapping along in agreement. On the show today, you know, everyone's talking about the State of the Union, but what about the state of the human is a question that the Brené Brown podcast will ask. This podcast, The Gist, will consider the State of the Union. But first, Sir David King is the founder and chair at Cambridge Center for Climate Repair, who is also the UK's chief scientific advisor. I and the producers were searching for someone who could explain technology that sometimes is derided by the most fervent climate activists, things like carbon technology, carbon capture. Sir David King is a proponent of these technologies. So I asked him to come by and try to convince climate skeptics that we need a bit of carbon capture and storage and removal as part of the solution mix. Sir David King up next. Winter, where I'm from, is not over. But I look at the bright side. I call it soup season. And I try to get all the ingredients, source the ingredients, master my recipe. And as I'm doing that, getting cash back on the purchases I make with Ibotta. Ibotta is the free app that gives you the most cash back every time you shop on hundreds of items, from groceries, spices, and stock, to beauty supplies, to toys. You beat inflation no matter what you're purchasing. Your average Ibotta user earns $145 a year. Don't you want $145 a year. You know what it costs you? It costs you nothing to use the app Ibotta. Get in on that. Other apps give you points that don't amount to much. With Ibotta, you just add your offers in the app, you upload your receipt, and then you get real cash that you can cash out to your bank account or PayPal or gift cards. Join the over 50 million savers and earn cash back every time you shop from over 2,700 brands and retailers, including Lowe's, Macy's, Sephora, Best Buy, and more. Right now, Ibotta is offering our listeners $5, wow, just for trying Ibotta, by using the code THEGIST when you register. This is free money upon free money. Go to the App Store or Google Play, download the free Ibotta app to start earning cash back, and use the code THEGIST. That's Ibotta in the Google Play or App Store, and use the code THEGIST. It will help you. It will help the show. And the soup you might make can help you, you know, clear up those block sinuses. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Carbon capture and storage and carbon dioxide removal are two technologies, promising technologies that should at least be part of the mix. But no, say some, they are false choices. And if we put too much of our resources towards them, we will take the mind and our efforts off the real prize, which is to keep temperatures below 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2 degrees Celsius. Well, joining me now is Sir David King. He's an emeritus professor of physical chemistry at the University of Cambridge. He was the UK government chief scientific advisor from 2000 to 2007 and the foreign secretary's special representative on climate change from 2013 to 2017. He's very much involved and very much in favor of these technologies. And we're going to do an interview where we address the critics head on and try to perhaps win over those who are skeptical, not just of the technologies working, but even of them being pursued. Sir David, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you, Mike. I'm delighted to be with you.
I think the most prominent concern that I hear about these technologies, and we'll get into the will they work, will they work well enough, and this was articulated by John Kerry, is the idea of the tipping point, which is that even if in the future we can get the technology online, it may be too late, and the polar ice caps could melt, and you can't get them back. And which I think you're going to be able to talk about. The coral reefs could go away and you can't get them back. And once a tipping point happens, there could be this feedback loop where having invested any time and effort into the technology that would be invented after the tipping point won't do anything. What do you say to the concerns of the tipping point?
So what I'm going to do is take you back to what is currently happening. When I was working in the climate negotiations leading up to 2015, I don't believe there was any real understanding of what is happening in the North Pole region. And in the North Pole region, we've been aware of the fact for some time now that the heating is about four times the rate of the rest of the planet. Now, in particular, over the last 15 years, the result is that the North Pole region, the entire North Pole region, is now on average 3 degrees centigrade plus above the pre-industrial level. So that 1.5, 2 degrees limit is now exceeded in that region. And the consequences are quite extreme for the whole planet. So on the one hand, we've got permafrost, which contains methane, and we're getting explosive release of methane. There's enough methane there that if it was all released over a 20-year period, temperature rises globally would be about 5 to 8 degrees centigrade. Right? Disastrous. But also up there is Greenland. And we've just had a report published in Nature, which is pointing out, I mean, this is a detailed calculation over the last 38 years of what the ice has been doing over Greenland. It is now being lost at 30 tons per hour. 30 tons of ice are going into the oceans per hour. And of course, that's raising sea levels. Since 1985, the estimate is that 1 trillion metric tons have been lost from Greenland and have gone into the ocean. Now, what that means is, quite possibly, and I'm referring back to what you were just saying, actually, the tipping point in the North Pole region may be tipping already.
Yes, we may have passed it. Yeah.
Yes, we might have passed it. Right. So what that's telling us is that the level of greenhouse gases we've got at the moment is already having a severe impact on our futures. Now, I must mention one more thing, which is the jet stream. The jet stream has been very severely distorted by the fact that we've got warm air over the North Pole during the polar summer. So let me just tell you, on the Climate Crisis Advisory Group that I chair, 15 people from 11 countries, all of them leading climate scientists, we had a member from the permafrost region of the planet. He lives up there on the permafrost, and he's a representative of the Sami and Inuit people who've lived up there for thousands of years. I spoke to him in April 2021, and we're chatting, and I said, "What's the temperature?" He said, "Well, it's bloody cold today. It's minus 32. What would it normally be? Minus 10, and we're used to that." He said, "Tomorrow it might be back up to minus 10. I spoke to him at the end of July the same year, just a few months later, and he said, "You better be sitting down. The temperature here is now plus 32. Plus 32.
So it is dire. The methane, or as we say, methane release, is exacerbated by a number of things, but one of them is the temperatures, which create more rain in events, and this erodes the ground soil. So these are all, as you know, these are all interconnected processes. Is the idea that the technology we're talking about, we could separate them or talk about them together, but the carbon captured and capture and the sequestration, is the idea that we have to commit to them before it's too late? Or is the idea that let's rebut the notion that we're going to reach a tipping point? If we're already at the tipping point, that's too far gone. It makes no sense to criticize carbon capture as a technology who won't be able to intervene in time. There's no such thing as intervening in time.
Mike, absolutely. So let me just say, without reduction of emissions, deep and rapid reduction of emissions, we're cooked. So everything I'm going to say now hinges around us continuing to make a much better effort to reduce our emissions deeply and rapidly. 2050 net zero, in my view, is just too late. But how do we buy time so that we can go through the process of reducing our emissions and also remove greenhouse gases at scale. So here's the two arguments for both removing the excess greenhouse gases that are already there causing these problems, and secondly, cooling the North Pole region during the polar summer so that we can retain the ice over the Arctic Sea that is a very thin layer formed during the polar winter, that we can retain it through the summer so that it will continue to reflect sunlight away, any sunlight that gets down there. And so this is a matter, by which I mean cooling the North Pole region, it's a matter of buying time so that we can reduce emissions and get on with the business of capturing carbon dioxide and methane and bringing our levels down. We are currently at over 500 parts per million of greenhouse gases altogether. 420 is carbon dioxide. Add in the methane, we're over 500. The pre-industrial level is 275. This is no way for a manageable future for humanity at that level. So what I'm saying is we've got to bring that down to something like 350 parts per million to create a manageable future. And that will take many, many years. We need to remove greenhouse gases at scale. That means tens of billions of tons of greenhouse gases, or particularly carbon dioxide, but methane as well, must be removed per annum going forward in time. And then we also need to see that we can repair, that means cool down the North Pole region. How do we do that? And there's several techniques that are under analysis and experimental work going on now to see whether we can do that. The cost of doing the experimental work, frankly, is minimal compared with the cost of the other processes, but the cost of rollout, particularly of cooling the North Pole region, that cost is going to be significant. And when I say significant, let's suppose it's talking about $3 to $5 billion. Is that a problem related to sea level rises of 1 to 2 meters taking out major cities around the world? We already know that the capital of Indonesia, Jakarta, is north region of the capital, under seawater right through the year now, with sea levels where they are. This is rising now year on year. By the time we get to mid-century, 80% plus of the landmass of Vietnam will be under seawater at least once a year. This is the third biggest rice producer in the world. We're talking about very severe problems for the human story going forward.
Yeah.
If we don't do something about it. So I'm just stressing the reason why we here in Cambridge are setting up global consortia to work on these projects is precisely because of the nature of the challenge.
By reducing emissions, are you saying do you endorse the idea that it is necessary to get to net zero emissions?
Oh, yes. I think we must. So let me take that as not.
Yeah. And if you can, talk about time frame as well.
Yes. So I'm talking about absolute emissions now. We must absolutely reduce emissions by, let's say, 90-95%, and the rest can be made up with some greenhouse gas capture. But greenhouse gas capture is to reverse the trend of increasing greenhouse gases, to bring it down from today's level, never mind tomorrow's level, to something like 350 parts per million. So it's an enormous challenge. And by the way, there's another practice that needs to be proceeded with right around the planet, which is resilience. Every region of the planet is already experiencing severe extreme weather events. Extreme meaning temperatures of 5 to 10 degrees centigrade above the highest previously observed. So, for example, that year I mentioned, 2021, the west coast of America suffered really extraordinarily high temperatures. This is the distortion that I mentioned earlier of the polar vortex, the jet stream, the distortion of the jet stream that is leading to these extreme weather events right around the world. We've got very big challenges on our hands right now. I do think we can manage it, but if we don't do the greenhouse gas capture at scale, and if we don't do the cooling of the regions of the planet where the temperature rise is causing major challenges. By the way, Antarctica is another challenge now. 2023, the sea ice around Antarctica that has been retained over many, many years, suddenly a large fraction of it was lost. The community studying this are absolutely horrified by this, because as that sea ice goes, the warm sea during, again, the polar summer, this time the South Pole summer, the warm sea threatens the ice on land. So I think we have, in my view, Mike, no choice. We have to follow all three: reduce, remove, repair, and then also develop resilience.
The estimate that you gave in the billions seems low to me. In fact, I'd sign up for that. The United States dedicated billions of dollars to this technology already. I don't know that that will be enough. I've seen estimates in the hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yes. So we're talking about cooling the North Pole region, and everything depends on the technology you use. What we are focused on at the moment is covering the North Pole, the Arctic Sea region, with white cloud cover during the polar summer so that we reflect the sunlight away from the ice that was formed in the winter. And that, to me, is a relatively low cost, although what we would have to have, because the idea is to pump tiny droplets of seawater into the warm air above the warm sea around the Arctic Circle region, and where the wind is blowing in the right direction, white clouds formed by this process are carried over the Arctic Sea. We have to know exactly what the meteorological information is, and we have to surround the Arctic region with vessels in the ocean. There's the capital cost. The running cost will be relatively low.
Is the technology up to the challenge? I ask because researchers for the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis looked at 13 projects, which accounted for half of the world's operational capacity of carbon capture and storage. And they found of the 13, so they looked at most of the world's projects, 7 underperformed, 2 failed, and 1 was mothballed. That's not very encouraging.
No, it's not at all encouraging. And I would say, for example, direct air capture is never going to achieve much. Right? Direct air capture, big fans pumping air through capture devices. The likelihood of managing this massive global problem with these big fans is just close to zero. So, yes, we've got to challenge each of these suggested processes. Now, what I'm working on is called marine biomass regeneration. And the project there is aimed at two objectives. One is to restore the ocean's biomass, that is mammals such as whales, fish, and crustaceans, back to the sort of level we had 400 years ago before whaling proceeded. Now, that project I'm pushing to restore the biomass of the oceans, which will benefit humanity because, obviously, we do depend on catching fish from the oceans. But the secondary process there is carbon capture. It is, at this point in time, much less certain how much carbon could be captured. But my belief is the minimum is going to be 1 billion tons a year, and it's likely to go up to 15 billion, that sort of level of carbon dioxide captured. So I think the question is it going to be permanently sequestrated? Always the key question. The work is ongoing, and it's probably going to take us another 3 years to get to the point where we feel satisfied that we can begin to roll this out.
Should the world stop eating fish or cut down its consumption of fish?
There is overfishing. What we need is marine protection areas multiplied. So we do have, the United States and Britain each have very large marine protection areas now. So reduced fishing, leaving it only for local people fishing from their islands, that is a very important way forward. But at the same time, climate change is changing the pattern of reproduction of fish in the oceans. And my own interpretation is taking out the baleen whales. The blue whale is down to less than 1% of its population 400 years ago. The first oil discovery was taking whales out of the ocean. And if whales were playing a crucial role in their mode of operation, eating krill, for example, 300 to 500 meters below sea level, and then coming up to the surface of the ocean to defecate, bringing fertile material into the sunlit surface area of the ocean, critical pathway to creating phytoplankton at the surface of the earth, which is the initial foodstuff of all fish larvae catching from eggs. So what we have done in taking out a part of the ocean biosystem, these baleen whales, was a critical pathway to reducing the amount of fish in the ocean. So my solution is no, we need fish for our consumption. And when we have brought the fish population back up to a reasonable level, then I think we can do that.
So I know you say we need this technology to work, and critics of this technology might agree with you, but they say, to be fair about it, to be accurate about it, there is no strong evidence that the technology will work. Tell me why your optimism is, or perhaps your desperation is rooted in reality. Why do you think the technology will work rather than we just need it to?
We've got lots of reasons to think this. So first of all, if we look at fertile material coming onto the surface of the ocean, fertile material comes from volcanic eruptions, for example. And so we've studied the volcanic eruption from Vanuatu and from Tonga, those two eruptions, fertile material spreading over large areas of the ocean and creating phytoplankton patches, and the phytoplankton patches creating large fish populations. I mean, typically, if you get a phytoplankton patch, which is several thousand square kilometers, you can find that the fish formed in that area might be a quarter of a billion 2 months later. So and those fish larvae forming that population would have died without the phytoplankton for the larvae to eat. So what I think, it's all based on observations that have been made over many, many years. And the way forward is then what we are doing experiments on. I can't promise that we can deliver until we've got all of the detailed results that will come from these experiments.
Sir David King is the founder and chair at Cambridge's Center for Climate Repair. He was the UK's chief scientific advisor. After that, he was the Foreign Secretary's special representative on climate change, and he's a professor emeritus at the University of Cambridge. Thank you so much, Sir David.
Thank you, Mike.
And now the spiel. The president has a requirement to inform Congress of what's going on. But it's not called the what's going on speech or the hey, what's up with that speech. That's bad. That's not good for branding. If it were called one of those things, I think we'd have a much better theme song.
What's up with that? What's up with that? Ooh-wee. What's up with that? What's up with that?
Sadly, the text of the Constitution does not say what's up with that. It says, quote, and this is from, of course, Article 2, Section 3, the president shall from time to time give to Congress information on the state of the union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. On the one hand, state of the union, that certainly seems to and has come to confer solemnity and import. On the other hand, the from time to time clause jumped out at me a little bit. You know, when the mood hits, should the president find himself in his bag. I hope I'm using that right. I am 52 years old. The president should from time to time address Congress, and they did from time to time, once a year really, address Congress. They often did it in writing. Calvin Coolidge began doing it in person. Silent Cal, for some reason, didn't elevate the speech to the blockbuster event it is today. FDR did. He began using the phrase State of the Union around 1935, and it soon became the colloquial expression for what presidents do from time to time. But State of the Union, it's a little bit of a phrase that does seem stuck in 1935, like other FDR phrases, ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished. It's a bit old, but also, I give it some credit, it's a bit grand. I don't want a lesser phrase. I just want it recognized that State of the Union, the occasion, is just a speech that tells us how things are going in the U.S. of A. And by the way, side note, I think all politicians and political commentators, if they all re-embraced the of in the U.S. of A, would be better off. The temperature would be lowered. Imagine every fiery critique of empire or hegemony alleging there is a deep rot inside the U.S. of A. Makes good down a little better, right? Or those chants at a jingoistic rally, U.S. of A, U.S. of A. It throws off the rhythm. It dilutes the ugliness. That, my friends, is an aspiration. But this, what follows, is a description, State of the Union, that describes the speech describing the Union. But then, State of the Union itself became a required phrase to utter in the State of the Union.
The State of the Union will remain sound and strong.
What is the state of our Union? It is growing stronger, but it must be stronger still.
The state of our union has never been stronger.
Despite our hardships, our union is strong.
The state of our union is strong because our people are strong.
The state of the union is strong because you, the American people, are strong.
I wonder if the founders are saying, how did these people get so literal? Having to say, the State of the Union is, it's a little like starting your sixth grade essay about what you did on your summer vacation with the phrase, what I did on my summer vacation was reduce inflation, cut prescription drug prices, and for the first time, make sure all people are paid a fair wage thanks to the Lilly Ledbetter Employment Act. Woo! I also jet skied. State of the Union, it's, I think this is right grammatically, I don't know, I hope so. It's an adjectival phrase, an adjective phrase, an attributive adjective phrase, I think it goes. There are other inert descriptive phrases that could get the treatment, the elevation that State of the Union has gotten. Like if every business that issued an income statement had to include, our income statement is robust, or our income statement is, we got a lot of income. Or take the phrase, you know, there is cause for concern. My cause for concern is child poverty, and my cause for concern is potable water. Well, my cause for concern is the death of nuanced roles for actresses over 50. Ah! The State of the Union, not the speech, but the phrase, is a brand, and it is a structure for others to riff on.
Hello, I'm Jake Tapper in Washington, where the state of our union is in a dangerous place.
Hello, I'm Dana Bash in for Jake Tapper in Washington, where the state of our union is testing loyalties.
The state of our union is alarmed.
Hello, I'm Brianna Keeler in New York, where the state of our union is wondering just how secure the storage rooms at Mar-a-Lago really are.
The state of our union is fearful. The state of our union is classified. The state of our union is frozen.
The state of our union is standing with Israel.
The state of our union is focused overseas.
The state of our union is reconsidering the use of Twitter as a diplomatic tool.
The state of our union is gearing up.
The state of our union is just utterly devastated.
I think it would be good if the other Sunday shows did this too. And today we will face the nation of America. Tomorrow on Face the nation we face is our own. For the 84th straight week on Face the Nation in question to be faced, shall be the U.S. of A. The union of the State of the Union speech combined with the State of the Union phrase in the State of the Union speech, well, it's in quite a state, is my point. Luckily, it's all delivered in D.C. Otherwise, we'd have to layer another state onto that whole mess. I have to say, judging by recent developments, the state of the State of the Union is clearly not in stasis.
Despite our hardships, our union is...
A momfluencer.
The state of our union is...
Moist.
The State of the Union is...
Slay!
Because you, the American people, are...
Slay!
That is right. President Obama said it best. We don't live in a red America or a blue America. We live in a moist momfluencer America. And that moist momfluencer is in the balcony with the First Lady. Give her a hand. You're not standing up, Mitch. All right, good. Now the State of the Union is truly strong. And that's it for today's show. Kari War is the producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson was the particular quaint mallard who was tortured with putting all that State of the Union tape together. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The State of our Union is cuddly, but also the State of our Union is kind of upset when I drop food on the floor after having midnight snacks. I know, a little too much information, but I am authorized from time to time to give you the State of the R Union in the credits. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Lipson's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu, gee peru, do peru. Thanks for listening.